Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and this is the 141st episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. And this will be focused on internal medicine. This is, I think, series 13, if I'm not mistaken. So I'll just jump right into it. So what if you get a question about 40-year-old female, you know, BMI is like 40, comes in with like pain in her like upper abdomen, her temperature is like 102, and she has a positive Murphy sign. What are you thinking about? Well, I would hope you're saying that she has a acute cholecystitis, right? Remember, for acute cholecystitis, what's your first step in diagnosis? You'd get a right upper quadrant ultrasound, right? And then after that, let's assume the right upper quadrant ultrasound is negative. What do you go for next? You should go for a HIDA scan. A HIDA scan is a nuclear medicine test. Essentially, if you don't see the gallbladder at like 90 minutes after you've like given morphine, that tells you that the person that has a very high sensitivity for acute cholecystitis. And obviously, acute cholecystitis, right? You treat it with a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. But there are a few variations that you want to be aware of, or I guess some other high yield factors you want to be aware of. The first thing you want to keep in mind is, if a person has acute cholecystitis, but they tell you that the classic imaging finding, right, or right upper coronary ultrasound is like the pericholecystic fluid, the gallbladder wall thickening, I think like 3 millimeters is the cutoff. And again, they'll have like a sonographic Murphy sign. That's the big one. Now, the thing is on the MBM is if they tell you that, oh, they see all these signs like the pericholecystic fluid, thickened gallbladder wall, but they add something to the descriptor and say that they do not see an obstructing stone, but you're seeing all these, you know, classic signs of acute cholecystitis, especially in a patient that, you know, is like on TPN, or the patient is on TPN, or the patient is like super sick in the ICU. Under those circumstances, you want to think about an acalculus cholecystitis. And under those circumstances, you absolutely do not want to do a cholecystectomy. You want to go ahead and do something called a percutaneous cholecystostomy. Okay? Those are things that's a weird variation. You don't do a cholecystectomy. They will try to trick you by putting cholecystectomy. Don't choose that option. It's associated with like increased morbidity and mortality in those patients that have acalculus cholecystitis. And then another weird iteration you may see on exams, right? They may describe a person that they tell you that how do I put this? They may describe a person that, you know, may have like an obstructing stone in the cystic duct or whatever, but they tell you that, oh, you also see like dilation of like the intrahepatic bowel ducts. And that's something that's usually tested on like surgery shelves, but again, it's something I can see them throwing in on step 2 CK. It's called like Meritzi's syndrome. Basically, the thing that happens is you have like a dilated cystic duct or an inflamed cystic duct that's compressing on the hepatic duct. So that causes like, you can essentially see like a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia where you have like dilation of the intrahepatic bowel ducts. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like right upper quadrant pain, has fever, they tell you that this patient has scleral icterus, this patient is altered, and the blood pressure is 80 over 48. What are you thinking about? I would hope you're telling me ascending cholangitis, right? And obviously, your next step in management under those circumstances is to get an ERCP. An ERCP is diagnostic and therapeutic. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient that just recently had like a repair of their spleen because they were in trauma? And then this patient has like referred, like they had like a surgical repair of the spleen from like a motor vehicle accident. And then they tell you that this patient has like a referred pain to the left shoulder. And this patient has like fevers. I would hope you're thinking about a subphrenic abscess under those circumstances. Obviously, you want to drain the abscess and that should hopefully fix whatever is going on. And then what if you get a question about a patient that just recently got treated for like acute pancreatitis? And then they tell you that, oh, on imaging or like on endoscopy or whatever, they find like isolated gastric varices. Under those circumstances, I really want you thinking about like a splenic vein thrombosis, right? Remember, weird venous thromboses are like high yield to know for step 2. Like the big ones, right? Splenic vein thrombosis with like acute pancreatitis, you want to know that one. Renal vein thrombosis with nephrotic syndrome, classically you see that with membranous nephropathy, you want to know that one. And then hepatic vein thrombosis, right, with Budd Chiari syndrome, kind of like a woman on OCPs, or you see it like in a patient with a polycythemia vera. Now, what if a patient has like like gnawing epigastric pain, and they've been on like chronic treatment for osteoarthritis? What does that patient have? That'll be peptic ulcer disease, right? That'll be peptic ulcer disease. And then if a patient has like epigastric pain, radiating to the back, and let's assume it's like an alcoholic or a patient with sickle cell, right? Obviously, you want to think about like acute pancreatitis under those circumstances. Some other high-yield things I guess I'll see with that is remember that there are certain drugs that can be associated with pancreatitis, especially like the HIV drugs, right? Like Stavudine and Didanosine. Those are ones they expect you to know for the exam. And then another high-yield thing to sort of circulate in your memory is you may see pancreatitis with some of these diabetes drugs like the GLP-1 agonists and the DPP-4 inhibitors. And then again, like basically, I'm just using this to sort of walk you through like some high-yield GI pathologies. Actually, let me go ahead and say this then, right? So there's this thing called like IgG4 related pancreatitis, like an autoimmune pancreatitis. It's kind of like a weird thing you want to stuck at the back of your mind because they occasionally test it in the context of like retroperitoneal fibrosis. Like their pancreas is, I think, on imaging looks like a sausage or something like that. Almost like a longitudinal ball of poop. If you see that, yeah, think about autoimmune pancreatitis. Those IgG4 related diseases are kind of high yield to know. It can cause like renal disease, pancreas disease, and stuff like that. And then, again, if a patient has like periumbilical pain progressing to the right lower quadrant, what are you thinking about, right? That's appendicitis, right? And then if a patient has like flank pain, kind of like radiating to the groin, and this patient also has hematuria, what do those people have? Those people have like nephrolithiasis, right? They have like a renal calculus. And then what if you get a question about like a 23-year-old female, she has like severe right lower quadrant pain, and she uses condoms inconsistently, what are you thinking about? That's an ectopic pregnancy, right? And then what if you get a question about like a 15-year-old female, she's had like a simple ovarian cyst, like 5 centimeters, that was detected like 6, 7 weeks ago at a pelvic exam, and then she has like this sudden onset severe abdominal pain. That's ovarian torsion, right? That's ovarian torsion. The thing is, you want to be able to differentiate ovarian torsion from like a ruptured something, like a ruptured cyst. The thing is, if they want you on your friends at the MBM, if they want you thinking about a ruptured cyst, they will see something about like free fluid in the peritoneal cavity. If you see the free fluid on imaging, if they tell you that expressly, you know that something has ruptured. If they don't tell you that, you know that nothing ruptured. Okay, it's just a torsion of whatever structure. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like cervical motion tenderness, adnexal tenderness, and vaginal discharge? I would hope you're thinking about PID, right? Pelvic inflammatory disease. Remember that this thing can ultimately involve like the hepatic capsule, right? That's what's called like the Fitzhugh-Curtis syndrome, right? And remember the big bugs that cause this problem, chlamydia gonorrhea. So obviously you want to give like ceftriaxone, azithromycin, or like ceftriaxone or plus a doxycycline. And these people, right, probably like in the few weeks or like early months after they have like the PID, probably doesn't make any sense to give those if these people are seeking contraceptive options, maybe an IUD is not the smartest thing under those circumstances. And then what if you get a question about like left lower quadrant pain in an 80-year-old female with fever? That's diverticulitis, right? Remember diverticulitis, you make the diagnosis with like a CT scan with contrast. You do not want to do a colonoscopy in the acute phase, but you need to do it like weeks later just to make sure they don't have a colon cancer. And then what if you get a question about like left lower quadrant pain, 80-year-old male, and then they tell you that he has like air bubbles or like poop in his urine? That's a colovesical fistula. Believe it or not, that's something your friends at the MBM love to test. Basically, they formed like a fistula between like their like sigmoid colon or whatever and their bladder, right? So they have that communication from all the inflammation of a diverticulitis. And then this one is just something that you either know or you don't. But what if they give you a question about like some patient on chemo and he has like a thickened cecum on abdominal CT scan? That's something called typhlitis. It's just something like typhlitis. It's just something you unfortunately want to commit to memory. It's just like a very severe form of a necrotizing enterocolitis. Now, what? Let's walk through. I get like some bleeding disorders. If, for example, a patient has hemolytic uremic syndrome, what will be true of their platelets? Their platelets will be low, right? Those people have like thrombocytopenia. Remember like the triad, right? Like microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, like renal failure. So, and these people usually have like E. coli 157H7 business going on, or like some kind of like sugar toxin crap going on, right? So their platelet count will be low. If their platelet count is low, their bleeding time will be high, right? For the most part, their PT and PTT should be normal. Now, what if you have a patient that has hemophilia A or hemophilia B? What should be true of their platelet count? It should be normal, right? How about their bleeding time? It should be normal as well. How about their PT? It should be normal. Very good. But how about their PTT? It should be increased. Very good. Okay, remember hemophilia A and B, they're both inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion, so should not show up in a girl on an NBME. And remember that hemophilia A is a factor 8, right? Remember A sounds like 8, and then hemophilia B is a factor 9 deficiency, right? Like B9. And then von Willebrand's disease, will be true of the platelet count. It'll be low, right? I mean, it will be normal, sorry. What we throw the bleeding time, it'll be elevated, right? Remember, it's a qualitative platelet defect, right? Von Willebrand's disease literally means you'll have a deficiency of von Willebrand factor, right? And the PT should be normal, and the PTT should be elevated, right? Because remember, von Willebrand factor is a protecting group for factor 8, right? So if you have a von Willebrand factor deficiency, you'll have like diminished survival of factor 8 in the circulation, right? So those people's PTT will go up, because the half-life of factor 8 goes down, right? And remember, like the risdiplam cofactor assay, something that may pop up on your tests is just something that tells you that a person has like some kind of problem with like the first step in primary hemostasis, right? That step that involves like GP1B9 and von Willebrand's factor. So if a person has like deficiency of von Willebrand factor, so like aka like von Willebrand disease, or a person has Bernard-Soulier syndrome where they have a deficiency of GB1B, those people will have an abnormal risdiplam cofactor assay. And then if a patient is in DIC, what do you expect? DIC is bad, right? Their platelet count will go down, they're consuming platelets, their bleeding time will go up because their platelet count is low, their coagulation factors are all down, so their PT, PTT will both be elevated. Basically, if you see every like lab all screwed up, always think about DIC. And then if a patient is on warfarin, what will be true of their platelet count and their bleeding time? Those should be normal, right? But if what should be true of their PT and their PTT? They should both be elevated. So here's the thing, right? Everyone says, if a person has it's a question. A lot of people get wrong on the NBMEs. If a person is on warfarin, we follow with the PT, so that means the PT should be the only thing elevated. That could not be further from the truth, right? Remember, warfarin inhibits vitamin K epoxide reductase. So you have issues like gamma carboxylating factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 and protein CNS. The thing is, factors like 2, like factor 7, fine. That's like the extrinsic coagulation cascade, so the PT goes up. But actually, remember that factor 10, right? And like factor 2, they sort of like common to both pathways. So those people's PTT also goes up. Same deal also goes with like heparin. Heparin also will cause elevations in your PT and PTT. Okay, don't say, oh, we follow heparin with PTT, so the PT must be normal. No, that is not true. The PT and the PTT go up if you're using heparin or warfarin, right? And remember, the way you reverse heparin is with like protamine sulfate. The way you reverse warfarin is with a four-factor PCC, right? So like the four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate. I think that's the thing that's called like a Kcentra in hospitals, if I'm not mistaken. And then if you're on aspirin, right, what should be true of your platelet count? Should be normal, right? What should be true of your bleeding time? It should be increased because aspirin, right, knocks out a cox, right? So your platelets, they are around, but they don't work right. And then your PTPTT should be normal. And then if a person has like liver disease, you're not making coagulation factors, so the PTPTT should be elevated. Your platelet count bleeding time is kind of variable. It's kind of all over the place. If you have like a splenomegaly, you have a thrombocytopenia, right? Because you're sequestering platelets in the liver. But that's a different story. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about... what if you get a question about... So let me make this like... MBME style question. So let's assume you have like a 45-year-old female, you know, she's HIV positive. She comes to a PCP, you know, for like routine follow-up. And then on physical exam, you notice that she has like bilateral pedal and periorbital edema. And then you're told that breath sounds are decreased in both lung fields bilaterally, and there's kind of like dullness to percussion. And then they give you some vitals, like the blood pressure is like 138 over 90, heart rate is 78 beats per minute, respiratory rate is 14 breaths per minute, temperature is 98.6, you know, white count 6700, so that's kind of normal. Hematocrit is 41%, so hemoglobin is like, you know, like almost 14, so that's kind of okay. PT is like 10 seconds, PGT is 20 seconds. And then they tell you that she has no recent history of like an upper respiratory infection. And your analysis, they tell you it's notable for like 4+ proteinuria. And then you're told that an upright chest x-ray or like a PA lateral chest x-ray shows like bilateral blunting of the costophrenic angles. And then this question says, thoracentesis of this fluid will most likely reveal what? So let me give you some options. Option A says an LDH of 500. Option B says a pH that's less than 7.1. Option C says like a fluid LDH that is 80% of serum LDH. Option D says fluid protein that is 40% of serum protein. And then option E says an abundance of polymorphonuclear leukocytes and gram-positive diplococci. I'll let you think about those for a second. What do you think the answer is? I would hope you're saying that the best answer is like option D, right? So in this case, you know, like fluid protein, that's like 40% of a serum protein, right? So again, let's kind of break this down, right? This patient has HIV, right? This patient, because they have 4+ proteinuria, that tells you that they likely have nephrotic syndrome, right? I mean, like 4+ proteinuria is essentially like a surrogate means for your friends on the MBME to tell you that a person has more than 3.5 grams of protein in their urine in 24 hours, right? And because this person is HIV positive, right, they likely have like FSGS, right? So like focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. Remember that nephrotic syndrome, right, it decreases oncotic pressure. It kind of tags along with this central construct that if you have anything that increases hydrostatic pressure or decreases oncotic pressure, that thing will be a cause of a transudative pleural effusion. Okay, so other things that can cause a transudative pleural effusion are things like CHF or like a PE. Although remember, a PE can cause both transudative and exudative pleural effusions. And then don't forget that cirrhosis, right? Because you are hypoproteinemic, like mostly from like the low albumin, right? So cirrhosis can also cause a nephrotic syndrome. And again, it's like floridly high yield to no lights criteria, right? And it's, again, it's kind of easy to remember, right? It's like fluid pleural fluid protein to serum protein, the ratio less than 0.5. If you take the ratio of like the pleural fluid LDH to serum LDH, it should be less than 0.6. And then the LDH should be like less than 2/3, right? Or less than 0.67, the upper limit of normal of a serum LDH. Basically, if you violate any one of these rules, the fluid is like, you essentially have like an exudative effusion. And the big things you want to think about there are things like malignancy, you know, like a PE, ARDS, a sort of deal. And really the easy way to, again, like I said, to remember the causes of our transudative effusions, just think about processes that decrease oncotic pressure, right? So like cirrhosis causes less albumin. Nephrotic syndrome, you're peeing albumin out in the urine, right? Menetrier's disease, you're losing protein in the GI tract. It's like a protein are losing an enteropathy, right? Or anything that increases hydrostatic pressure, again, like CHF or a PE. Those are all things that will cause a transudative effusion on exams. Now, let me again ask you another like step 2 CK style question. So what if you have like a 55-year-old guy, you know, he develops like progressive dyspnea like 2 days after emergent surgery for a type A aortic dissection. And then, so this must tell you that this guy probably had like a pretty, you know, pretty bad hospital course. And then they tell you that on ABG, you'll find like a pH of 7.47. His PCO2 is 34. His P little AO2, so that like his arterial oxygen tension is 58. Right, so he's kind of hypoxic, and then his CVP, right, so his central venous pressure, which is like a proxy for right atrial pressure, is like 8, and they tell you that his pulmonary capillary wedge pressure is 14. That's important to know. And then his BMP is 97, right? So like he's a B type of natriuretic peptide is a 97. And then they tell you that on auscultation of the chest, you'll find like bilateral crackles. And then they may show you a chest x-ray that may have like this back wing appearance. I'll encourage you to look this up. And then they say, what is the most likely mechanism behind this patient's dyspnea? And then you get like five answer choices, right? And then option A says like left ventricular systolic dysfunction, right? And then option B says increased systemic vascular resistance. And option C says like pulmonary edema from impaired myocardial contractility. And then option D says increased permeability of pulmonary vasculature. And then option E says consolidative processes from like an intraparenchymal lung infection. If you see that, what do you think the right answer here is? Again, I will encourage you, whenever you get an NBME question, make a diagnosis first. It makes your life so much easier. This person has ARDS, right? This person has ARDS. So the right answer here should be like kind of like option D, right? Like increased pulmonary vascular permeability. The big thing I kind of wanted to point out with this question is you want to be able to differentiate between like a cardiogenic and a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? Non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema is essentially like ARDS. ARDS is like the big cause on USMLE exams. You want to be able to associate that with like a normal pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. Okay, I remember the PCWP is indicative of the left atrial pressure, right? If the PCWP is less than 18, that's the magic number you want to remember. If it's less than 18, that tells you that you're dealing with a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, most likely ARDS on exams, right? And again, they'll have like a normal BNP telling you that the heart is functioning just fine. And really, the ARDS in a QSTEM, they'll kind of disguise it as like, you know, like a super sick ICU patient who has like new onset dyspnea, really bad hypoxia, kind of like a few days after admission. They'll have like a P little AO2 to FiO2 ratio that's usually less than 200, right? And then they'll show you like a chest x-ray that has like this bat wing appearance, so like essentially like a wide out lung. Just look up a picture online or an image online of like ARDS chest x-ray. It's pretty striking. It's something you want to actually be able to recognize on exams. Right, really the way you treat this is kind of like supportive care. I mean, obviously the patient will be on a vent, right? The big thing you want to do is high PEEP, low tidal volumes, right? Like you want to essentially use a long protective strategies in fixing this patient's a problem. Although the mortality of ARDS is pretty bad, it's like I think like 40% or some high number, although it's been decreasing in recent years with these long protective strategies are being used. Now let's I guess run through some quick scenarios with like diarrhea. Let's run through some quick scenarios with diarrhea. So what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has watery diarrhea and they recently like returned from a trip to Mexico? That's ETEC, right? Enterotoxigenica E. coli. Remember, it's like traveler's diarrhea, Montezuma's revenge. What if you get a question about a patient that has like watery diarrhea with like rice water stools? That's Vibrio cholerae, right? Basically, this people lose like a crap ton of fluid. You can give like tetracycline, you can give a macrolide. And remember that those people, you need to rehydrate them with a salt sugar solution, right? Basically like oral rehydration therapy. And then what if you get a question about like watery diarrhea in like a hiker or like a camper? Or they may describe a person that has like IgA deficiency or like Bruton's A gamma globulinemia. Think about like a Giardia lamblia, okay? Remember Giardia, you treat that with metronidazole. And then what if you see like watery diarrhea on a cruise ship? That's like the norovirus, right? Or like Norwalk virus. What if you see like watery diarrhea in an infant, right? That's rotavirus, right? That's rotavirus. Remember, it's a single-stranded, I was thinking about parvo-B19. Parvo-B19 is the single-stranded DNA virus. It's just one of those weird things you still want to retain in your mind for step 2 CK. But rotavirus, it's actually vaccine preventable, but you don't want to give that vaccine to people that have a history of intussusception or Meckel's diverticulum or there's one more syndrome or like Henoch-Schönlein purpura. You want to avoid the rotavirus vaccine in those three populations of people. And then what if you see like watery diarrhea in an AIDS patient? That's Cryptosporidium, right? Don't choose Cryptococcus in the heat of an exam. Choose a Cryptosporidium parvum. Remember, it's acid fast. So they may say like, oh, examination of the stool shows acid fast oocysts. You can pretty much stop reading the question if you see that. That's Cryptosporidium parvum. Really, the way you treat that is like with, there's this drug called paromomycin. But another drug you can also use is something called nitazoxanide. Okay, it works pretty well for those purposes. And then, what if you get a question about a patient that has like bloody diarrhea after like consuming beef? That's like Shigella, right? Remember, EHEC, enterohemorrhagic E. coli, Campylobacter jejuni can also cause those. And then, actually, I will say one thing with Campylobacter jejuni. It's actually the most common cause of bloody diarrhea in the U.S., okay? And don't forget the association with, like, Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? Guillain-Barré syndrome, like, symmetric ascending paralysis. Remember, you treat that with, like, you know, plasmapheresis or, like, IVIG. And remember that if you check the CSF of those people, you'll find a ton of protein, but you're like, oh, crap, all this protein. Why am I seeing only, like, one or two white blood cells? That's the thing called the classic albuminocytological dissociation. And remember that Guillain-Barré syndrome, don't only think about it with like GI infection. You can also say with like upper respiratory infections and stuff like that. And then what if they describe a patient that has diarrhea after, you know, getting like antibiotics of any sort, right? That's C. diff, right? And remember, C. diff, it's the toxin that screen that patient over. And C. diff first line is actually like vancomycin, right? Before it used to be metronidazole, right? You may hear like in my super old podcast, metronidazole, but no, that's no longer first line. These days, first line is a vancomycin. And then what if a patient has like diarrhea, like bloody diarrhea, and they have like, you know, like right lower quadrant pain, and they tell you that this patient has has consumed pork recently, right? I hope you're thinking about like Yersinia, more specifically Yersinia enterocolitica, right? Is the thing that causes like the pseudoappendicitis. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that has like bloody diarrhea and they have like a liver abscess? I would hope you're thinking about like E. histolytica, so like Entamoeba histolytica. I remember that's classic, you treat that with like metronidazole. If they have like a liver abscess, you want to like inject something called iodoquinol into the abscess. It sort of kills off everything there. What if a patient has like bloody diarrhea and they have like low platelets, low hemoglobin, and elevated creatinine? That's HUS, right? That's hemolytic uremic syndrome, right? So you're thinking about like EHEC, like enterohemorrhagic E. coli under the circumstances, or like Shigella, right? And remember, Shigella, you just need like less than, actually like a little under 10 microbes to cause a really bad, nasty region infection. And then what if a patient has like diarrhea and they recently like consumed oysters or seafood? What are you thinking about? That's like Vibrio parahemolyticus, right? But what if they tell you about a person that has like, you know, like very bad, like morbidity, mortality, they consume oysters and they have a history of like cirrhosis or some like liver pathology? Think about Vibrio vulnificus. Okay. Think about Vibrio vulnificus. It has like this association of like bad morbidity and mortality in people that have like some kind of like liver pathology. And then, if they give you a question about a patient that, it's not a diarrhea thing, but if a patient like, you know, swam in fresh water and then they die quickly, like 3-4 days later, think about this bug, Naegleria fowleri. That's like a weird thing your friends at the MBME occasionally love to test, right? And then if you see like diarrhea and like a ton of vomiting after consuming like reheated like rice or like fried rice, or you see like some kind of Asian restaurant fried rice, and then the person has like permanent like diarrhea and vomiting, think about Bacillus cereus, right? It has a toxin, I think, known as like cerulide that causes like the permanent vomiting you'll find with it. I know I've certainly had a B. cereus before. I ate fried rice, although it was Nigerian fried rice, but whew, that thing is terrible. I like essentially like threw up for like 3 days straight. It's a terrible thing to have. It's not ideal, I'll tell you that. Okay. Now, what if a person has like diarrhea like 2 hours after consuming like potato salad or like at a picnic? That's Staph aureus, right? Usually it's more vomiting, less diarrhea. So I think, yeah, I think I should maybe stop there with regards to these diarrheal causes. And then let me do one more question and then we'll call it a day, right? So again, another MBME style question. So what if they tell you, you know, you have a 44-year-old guy, brings his 5-year-old son to the emergency room, and this 4-year-old son, you know, has like a 4-hour history of like profuse sweating, this son is drooling, has watery diarrhea, and they tell you that, oh, this kid has never had these symptoms before, he has been home for the past week, you know, kind of exploring the house, And they give you some vitals, right? You get like a blood pressure, it's like 89 over 58. Heart rate is like 33 beats per minute. Temperature is like, you know, 99.1, so not too high. And the respiratory rate is 8, right? Notice this kid is bradycardic. This kid is a little hypotensive. And then they tell you that physical exam is notable for like diffuse wheezing in all lung fields. And this kid has like bilateral papillary constriction. And they tell you that this kid's mom has like a 3-year history of like diplopia and dysarthria that is worse by the end of the day. That's a hint. And then they tell you that his dad noticed a pill bottle on the floor of the child's playroom, but cannot remember the name of the medication. Of course, they'll never remember the name of the medication on NBMEs. And then they ask, what is the next best step in the management of this patient? So I'll give you 5 options. Option A, let's say atropine, right? Option B, let's say naltrexone therapy. Option C, let's say physostigmine. Option D, let's say intramuscular administration of flomazenil. And then for option E, let's assume it's a nebulized pilocarpine. So what are you thinking about here, right? Or what do you think the best answer is? Think about it for a second. Maybe pause the podcast and try to figure out the answer. The answer here is A, right? So this is atropine, right? I mean, essentially, this patient's mom has like myasthenia gravis. And if you think about it, right, the way you treat myasthenia gravis is with like an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, like pyridostigmine. Remember, you get rid of myasthenia with pyridostigmine, right? Basically, by giving the acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, that bumps up levels of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, right? Because remember, myasthenia gravis is where you make like autoantibodies against the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor at the neuromuscular junction. It's the thing that, you know, kind of like worsens with you. So they will tell you that, oh, a person has like a decremental response with repetitive nerve stimulation. That's myasthenia gravis, right? So this kid probably, you know, swallowed one of those pills and it's kind of like getting like symptoms of cholinergic excess. So like bradycardia, the kid is drooling, the kid has diarrhea, the kid is sweating. So really your right step is to try to administer something that essentially like blocks those cholinergic receptors, right? So things like atropine, for example. To kind of discuss the other answers, remember, physostigmine is used to treat myasthenia gravis. It's used to treat like an atropine overdose, right? You fix an atropine overdose with physostigmine because atropine, right, if they describe a Jim Sandwich style question, you give physostigmine because physostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, so it'll bump up the levels of acetylcholine, so it can essentially like bump off the atropine from the muscarinic receptors. Flomazenil, right, is used to reverse like benzodiazepine overdose, although you can also use it to reverse like the Z drugs that are used for insomnia, so drugs like zolpidem, Zaleplon, Zobiclone, those Z drugs, you can reverse their deleterious effects with flomazenil. And then naloxone, naltrexone, you can use those to treat opioid dependence. To reverse opioid overdose, although the one you really should choose on exams is naloxone. Do not choose naltrexone. Naltrexone is used more for like opioid dependence. It can also be used to help with like smoking cessation. And then pilocarpine is like a cholinergic agonist, right? You use it to treat like glaucoma. You can use it also to treat Sjogren's, right? Because by being a muscarinic agonist, it'll aid in the production of saliva, right? So you can give it to patients with like Sjogren's syndrome. And you may say, but Divine, this patient had like pinpoint pupils, like the papillary constriction, right? The thing is, pinpoint pupils, yes, that can be opioid overdose, but those people will have like constipation, right? Not diarrhea, right? Remember like drugs like loperamide, it's an opioid. It's like kind of like the active ingredient, like in Imodium, right? It's used for diarrhea. It causes constipation it causes constipation. That's why I use it for diarrhea, because you're taking advantage of the constipationist side effect. And I guess to go ahead and stop, remember that, loperamide, you can also use it to treat like IBS like D, so like IBS with like a diarrhea component. That IBS with a diarrhea component, you essentially treat it with something that causes constipation. So like loperamide, which is a synthetic opioid, you can use a tricyclic antidepressant. Remember that has like anticholinergic activity, so that will help there. But for IBS with like constipation, you give something that causes diarrhea, right? So you can give like a stool softener. You can give this drug called a lubiprostone that pops up quite a bit on NBM exams. It's like a chloride channel activator. So chloride will come into the lumen, water will follow. So you get like a secretory diarrhea to sort of help with the constipation or symptoms of of IBS C, right? Well, do remember in IBS they won't have any physical exam abnormalities, they will not have any lab abnormalities, so that's a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. So I guess I'll go ahead and stop here. I hope you get something from this podcast. Again, as I say at the end of every podcast, I tutor a lot of things. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, Medicine in Training Exam, ABIM Board Exam, College Physics, Gen Chem, OChem, Biochem, Histology, Physiology. And then if you're like a preclinical med student, I tutor all the preclinical exams. If you're a third year med student, I tutor all the shelf exams. And then I do this longitudinal tutoring thing that, again, I've been sort of mentioning in a recent podcast. I've done it for quite a while. I essentially tutor you all through like your first years of med school, and then tutor you during your step one dedicated period. Or if you're studying now third year, I tutor you for all your shelf exams. And then I tutor you during your step two CK dedicated period. Basically, when I work with these people, I meet them for like 2 to 3 hours every week. And then I infuse, like, so say, for example, like the preclinical student, I infuse step one knowledge with each of your preclinical blocks so that when you hit your dedicated period, you're like super ready for step one. Same thing with like the third year shelf students. I sort of like, again, prepare them avidly for step two CK all through like their third years, so that again when they hit their step two CK dedicated period, they're like super super ready for the exams. So I'll do like teaching with the MBME questions, and I'll also teach you like test taking strategy. So it has worked out extremely well for people that I have done this longitudinal tutoring with. And then if you're a med student applying for like ERAS, like residency, I do offer like one-on-one advising and consulting for that. If you're a college student applying to like med school, again, same deal. Advising, consulting, like personal statement writing, editing your application, mock interviews, letters of recommendation, stuff like that. I do offer all those things. Again, if you're an international medical graduate, I work with a lot of international medical graduates. Feel free to reach out to me. I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction with these things. Essentially, every international medical graduate I've worked with has matched, right? And most of them have matched into like their first choices. So again, I have a lot of experience. If you need any of these things, reach out to me through the website or send out an email, divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So I do hope you have a wonderful day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.